Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we'll hear a recorded interview with Dr. Lynn Ringenberg, current president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, by one of our hosts, Craig Lubo. They spoke about climate change, toxins, and nuclear power. We'll get an update from Jill Erickson as well with the Heartland Conservation Alliance about the efforts by the Save Our Neighborhoods, Save Our Woods group in Independence. And in studio, we have Elizabeth Bijan with Revolve KC. Revolve is a nonprofit that believes the bicycle is the simple solution for healthy lifestyle and affordable, earth-friendly transportation. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have your environmental news. NewsTribune.com reports, the nation's longest rail-to-trail conversion is about to get even longer. Governor Jay Nixon announced Thursday that a 47-mile stretch of the Rock Island Trail from Windsor to Pleasant Hill will be added to the existing Katy Trail by the end of 2016, bringing the already lengthy stretch of trail from up to 287.5 miles across Missouri. Quote, as outstanding as the Katy Trail is today, we are committed to making it even better, end quote, Nixon said. Nixon said the Katy Trail is one of the true gems of our park system and generates nearly $18.5 million per year in economic impacts. Nixon's announcement Thursday was made at the Katy Trail State Park in North Jefferson City, along with Jefferson City Mayor Carrie Targan and Missouri State Parks Director Bill Bryan. The Katy Trail is now 25 years old and stretches across almost the entire state. Nixon said since 2009, there has been $4.5 million invested in improvements for the Katy Trail, including spurs and bridges. A further Rock Island rail-to-trail conversion is also being discussed, but has yet to substantially move forward. The full Rock Island corridor is a 144-mile stretch from Kansas City to near St. Louis, and, if connected to the Katy Trail, could create more than 400 miles of a continuous trail. Phys.org reports, Mother Nature will be delivering a future gift of 2% more wind energy in the Midwest if regional climate models are correct, according to research from Wake Forest University. In a study recently published online by the journal Renewable Energy, Robert Earhart, assistant professor of mathematics and statistics, and 2015 Wake Forest graduate Dana Johnson, used data to project impacts of climate change on wind energy density in the United States. They compared data from current and future time periods. Winds are caused by pressure gradients, which arise from things like the uneven heating of the atmosphere by the sun, the irregularities of the Earth's surface, and the rotation of the Earth. When captured by wind turbines, this motion can be used to generate electricity without using water. The researchers used data from four independently built climate models housed by the North American Regional Climate Change Assessment Program, which warehouses all of the regional climate models for North America. All four models showed very strong agreement that wind energy density is projected to increase by more than 2% in a region encompassing Kansas, Oklahoma, and northern Texas. Quote, if by the mid 21st century these projections hold, they just got 2% more energy for free, end quote, Earhart said. It's like a gift. EcoWatch.com reports, it's probably the last place you would think of for growing food, but 100 feet below London, the one-year-old startup Growing Underground is producing what it calls, quote, sustainable and mouth-wateringly fresh microgreens and salad, end quote. It's the world's first subterranean farm. The site, a bomb shelter during World War II, was abandoned for 70 years until entrepreneurs Richard Ballard and Stephen Dreen came along. Once fully operational, it's estimated that the system will be able to produce between 11,000 and 44,000 pounds of produce each year. Quote, the whole system runs automatically with an environmental computer controlling the lighting, temperature, nutrients, and airflow, end quote, said Stephen Dreen, co-founder of the parent company Zero Carbon Food. The company says, quote, using the latest hydroponic systems and LED technology, our crops can be grown year-round in the perfect pesticide-free environment that these forgotten tunnels provide, end quote. The company is currently growing radish and mustard leaf and also watercress, Thai basil, and other microgreens. Growing Underground claims it is carbon neutral and is working on certification, and it touts a number of other environmental benefits. They've pledged that their produce will travel no further than the M25 motorway that encircles Greater London. The project is just one of the many creative ways cities around the world are relocalizing agriculture. For instance, cities with a vast underground network like London, subterranean farming makes sense. In the U.S., many cities are turning abandoned warehouses into vertical farms. And after finding little oil and natural gas, Royal Dutch Shell announced today it would end its controversial Arctic drilling operations in the Chukchi Sea off Alaska's coasts, quote, for the foreseeable future, end quote. Shell said the amount of oil and gas found in the Burger J well is, quote, not sufficient to warrant further exploration, quote, end quote. The well will be sealed and abandoned in accordance with U.S. regulations, the company said. The oil giant is also making efforts to safely demobilize people and equipment from the Chukchi Sea. Shell said its decision to cease drilling was also based on, quote, the high costs associated with the project and the challenging and unpredictable federal regulatory environment in offshore Alaska, end quote. According to the Associated Press, Shell spent more than $7 billion on Arctic offshore exploration. The company said it expects to lose approximately $4.1 billion as a result of ceasing operations. And now I would like to introduce the interview we are going to play. It's a recording by Craig Lubo, and he is interviewing the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Lynn Ringenberg. And they spoke about climate change, toxins, and nuclear power.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us on Eco Radio. Today is Dr. Lynn Ringenberg. She is a physician from Florida. She's practiced medicine for 35 years, and she is professor emeritus at University of South Florida. She is currently the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Hey, let me, for those of our listeners that don't quite know exactly what Physicians for Social Responsibility do, if you can just give us some background on what they do.
Okay, I'll kind of give you a little recap. It's Physicians for Social Responsibility, PSR, and it was started as a nonprofit back in the early 60s, I think 1961, by a group of physicians, and so that's the name Physicians for Social Responsibility, but it's inclusive of all health professionals and others that are involved with the work, that want to be involved with the work that we do around climate change and health and nuclear weapons and environmental toxics. But anyway, it started back in 61 when physicians were noticing that children coming in had a lot of discolored baby teeth. And when those baby teeth fell out, they tested them and found high levels of strontium-90, which is a highly reactive radioactive waste product of nuclear atmospheric testing. And at that time, we were doing a lot of testing in the atmosphere of our nuclear weapons. And this eventually led to the Limited Test Ban Treaty. And then with PSR's continued work, at this time we were just working on nuclear weapons issues, and with a lot of pressure from the community, a lot of grassroots pressure, and also from our colleagues in Europe even, IPPNW, which is the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, we were able to push our leaders in Washington to give us the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which then made atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons unlawful, which led to the Nobel Peace Prize, which we shared in 1985. And shortly after that, we started looking at environmental issues, environmental toxins at coal-fired power plants and coal ash waste, and started working on those issues as they relate to health. Everything that we do, the work that we do, is as it relates to health. And these things, these issues that we work on are really, we feel, the gravest threats to human health and survival. And then in the mid-90s, we also added climate change and health to our mission. And those are the three things that we really work on today. Nuclear weapons, climate change and health, and environmental toxics.
Okay. And you mentioned name the the radioactive toxin with the
strontium-90. Strontium-90.
Okay. Uh-huh. And so are you saying that most of that came from the atmosphere from nuclear testing?
It came from nuclear weapons explosions in the atmosphere from testing, yes. It's the only way that you can get strontium-90. It's not found naturally. It's in the environment. It's only found from nuclear explosions, and they were happening, obviously, in the atmosphere at that time in our country.
All right. Yeah. And since they've stopped, well, I guess they haven't really stopped, because they still do some testing.
But not in the atmosphere. It's underground. It's underground.
Okay. All right. And so has that made a difference in the how often that toxin is found in children or anybody else?
Oh, absolutely. I think at the time, and I honestly can't tell you, I don't know that they did follow-up teeth studies, but at the time they tested thousands of children's teeth all over the country and found, you know, high levels of strontium-90.
Okay.
And yes, we're not seeing that because we're not seeing that discoloration in children's teeth like we did back then in the 60s.
All right. And what about in other countries? Are you following what other countries are doing? Are they complying with the test ban treaties? Or is there a problem with some nations still doing atmospheric testing?
As far as I know, there is no atmospheric testing done of nuclear weapons.
Okay. What about, I'm thinking specifically like countries like North Korea.
North Korea. I think they're underground. You know,
okay.
I'm not an expert on that, but I think I'm not aware of them doing atmospheric testing. But
So what are some of the other toxins associated with nuclear testing? Is there anything that would be associated with the underground testing?
You know, again, it's not exactly a field that I have studied extensively. I think that we have seismic techniques today that can detect underground testing, and I think we have discovered that from time to time in other countries. But as far as testing for any kind of uranium, nuclear, strontium, I don't think that we do that. We certainly don't as a nonprofit.
So now, you mentioned you're involved in organization with climate change issues.
Mm-hmm.
Have you or anybody else in the organization had any input on the new Pope's encyclical?
Well, we like many are excited about what the Pope is saying. I had a couple quotes I was going to see if I could share from the Pope, but not so much on climate as on nuclear weapons. He's also talked very strongly about banning nuclear weapons. And one of the comments that he made recently was that anyone who makes weapons or invests in weapon industries like we have in Kansas City is a hypocrite if they call themselves Christian. I mean, I think that Pope Francis is doing a lot to make people aware of the issues of climate change and nuclear weapons in the world, and I think that's a very positive thing. We have not met personally with the Pope on climate change and health. We have PSR is hosting a large climate and health summit in D.C. a few days before he comes to Washington in September. Our summit is September 20th. It's a Sunday. It's for health professionals and really anybody who wants to learn about the health effects from climate change. It'll be a full day, and you can go to our website at psr.org and find more information on that for anybody that's interested. And then on Monday, we're going to have a lobby day. And then I believe Pope Francis is coming the 24th or so to Washington. And I believe they have planned a moral march around his visit that has been pushed back a little bit. Initially, it was going to be on the same day that we were having our summit, and we were all going to do it together, but I think they pushed it back to coincide with the Pope's trip to Washington. So that's kind of exciting, and I think it's making people more aware of this grave issue in our society, in our world.
And do you think that's going to help politically? Are politicians going to listen more because of the Pope? Or?
Boy, who knows, huh? Who knows about politicians? You would hope that some would, but, you know, we have those climate deniers that just, I don't think we're going to probably change their minds. But, you know, I think President Obama has just done a terrific job with his new Clean Power Plan, and I think that, you know, the United States should be the leader in that. And, you know, it's going to take more than just the United States cutting carbon pollution. It's a global effort, obviously, and with China being one of the biggest producers, I mean, we're going to have to make sure that other countries are cutting carbon as well, else we're not going to get where we need to be to protect our planet.
No, I've seen reports China's adding approximately one coal plant every day of the year.
Well, I've seen those too, and we all hope that they're going to kind of rethink some of that, because I think there's little doubt. I mean, when 98% of the world's most brilliant scientists and people that study this say that, you know, it's a problem and we have to stop using coal. You know, we ought to leave these fossil fuels in the ground. And I think that, you know, hopefully they'll get on board with this.
Now, to their credit, too, I've also seen that while they're doing that, and we want them to stop, of course, that they also are producing more wind and solar energy than we are. They're leading the role in that.
They are. They absolutely are. Yeah. But you can't keep, you know, you could have all the wind and solar in the world, but if you keep pushing more carbon in there, it's not going to work. You know, we've got to get that carbon down.
And so looking at the carbon issues, what are some of the health effects that you're focusing on as it relates to coal and climate change?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's, I don't know if you have coal plants in Kansas City. What your main source of energy is. We certainly have them in Florida, in the northern half of Florida. In the southern half, we have more nuclear and plants. But, the main thing with the carbon pollution, it's not the carbon dioxide, because we breathe that in and out, you know, of our lungs, but it's the pollutants that accompany that, and the nitrous oxide and the sulfides and the particulate matters, PM2.5, which is a substance that all of these contribute to the increase in ozone and soot levels in our societies. And so, and they cause a number of things. They cause inflammation in our hearts, in our lungs, in our brains. So we see an increase in stroke. We see an increase in cardiovascular disease. We obviously see a huge increase in pulmonary disease, and especially in children, asthma, more so in minority populations, African-American populations, Hispanic populations, because they live closer to where coal-fired power plants are located. You know, I don't think you'll ever see a coal plant co-located next to a gated community. They're more where our underserved populations live. And so you have the coal pollution, the mercury, gets in the air, gets in the water. Mercury is devastating to the development of children. It's, PSR's mantra has been to prevent what can't be cured. We can't, as physicians, and this is what we're trying to get out to the world, is we're educators and we advocate for health. And we know that we can't cure someone who's been exposed to a nuclear radiation. We know we can't cure a baby who's been exposed as a fetus in utero to mercury and now has brain damage. We know we can't cure those things, and so we know that we could prevent them. So I think cutting back on the burning of fossil fuels, eventually getting rid of it totally, and you know, we can do that. There's an excellent website. It's called thesolutionsproject.org. thesolutionsproject.org, and Mark Jacobson, who's an engineer and scientist and a friend, and we hosted him in Florida last year. He has come up with a scenario for every state in our country to be totally off of fossil fuels by 2050, if not before. So the technology is there, but the political will isn't. But we know by cutting fossil fuels now, you'll see immediate benefits in health. You'll see immediate less asthma in kids, less heart disease, less stroke. Those are immediate benefits that you're going to see just by cutting the carbon pollution. And then long term, we'll see hopefully lessening of our climate changing.
We talk about the impacts there of the toxins that accompany the carbon. When it comes to just the global warming issue aspect of it, are there additional health concerns that you're concerned about that the global warming would cause independent of the toxins?
Well, yeah, global warming causes some other things. You know, we're seeing, and I mean, you're seeing it in Kansas now, we're seeing it all over the country, increase in heat. You know, that's going to be a major problem as our planet continues to warm, is heat, heat stroke, heat exhaustion. There have been huge heat-related deaths in Europe, in Russia, and in Europe over the past 10 years. You know, and again, it's the elderly, it's the young that don't tolerate the heat very well. There are certain medications that make you less tolerant of heat, so you could more easily die, like blood pressure medications, some medicines for mental health problems. It's something called, you know, we need to thermoregulate, and most of us do that very nicely. We can, you know, we can tolerate heat by sweating, and but some people don't do that very well on certain medications. And certainly old people and infants can die very quickly when they're exposed to heat because they can dehydrate. So heat exposure is a biggie from climate change. I think the increase in fires that we're seeing, air pollution from that, obviously our climate changing is causing this dynamic of sea level rise. Not something I guess you'll see here in Kansas, but we're certainly seeing it now in Florida. I mean, we're getting saltwater intrusion into our aquifer. We'll see less potable water in the world. We're seeing that already as the climate heats and the planet heats and water is...
There's an aquifer in western Kansas. I'm spacing out that. and drying out. And that location where they want to build another coal plant, which I think we have stopped that from being built.
Well, I hope so.
I don't think it's going to come back, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah.
They certainly still want to build that coal plant. It's the Holcomb plant expansion.
Wow.
And
yeah.
That would use more water.
Absolutely.
And leave them even with probably dry out the aquifer out there.
Well, I think, you know, it's a real concern in the world. It's a concern in this country, but it's a concern of all the world's people. And I think, you know, you look at what's happening in California. I mean, and then the drought, the lack of water in Texas. So it is a concern. And then, like I said, in the coastal cities with saltwater intrusion, and these plants do take a lot of water. You look at fracking. I don't know if they're fracking in Kansas. They want to frack in Florida. Hydraulic fracturing, where they
do that in Kansas too.
Would they inject these 600 plus toxics into the soil and break apart the earth a mile down? And then it takes millions of gallons of water per frack, 3 to 5 million gallons of water per fracking site, and there may be 5, 6, 10 fracking sites on a pad, and they're using all of this potable water. It's not, you know, it's the water out of, it's our drinking water, essentially.
And besides depleting the resources, what impact does that have on the quality of the water? Contamination that's getting into the drinking supplies?
It absolutely is being contaminated. It absolutely is. I mean, there are a number of scientific studies showing pollution from fracking into the water system.
One other toxin that I know we've dealt with in the past from the coal plants has been the sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
What are the health implications of the sulfur?
Well, I think mostly with that, it's the combination of the sulfur with the heat and the nitrous oxide, you know, producing your ozone, and so I think that's the issue there. And then, you know, when you have all that coal burning, what are you doing with the waste? You know that coal ash contains the most toxic chemicals on the planet Earth. And, you know, we've had some big coal ash disasters, you know, in Tennessee and recently in the Dan River in North Carolina. And so I think that's something that needs to be addressed as well. And this coal ash is often very, very concentrated with toxics. I mean, you may have scrubbers and things in your smokestacks to make the pollutants that go out the top a little less toxic, but then it makes your coal ash more toxic, the waste product. And that sometimes is just thrown in open pits, sometimes without a liner. The liners leak, they degrade over time. I think that's something that we have to look carefully at, too. It leaches into our water system, and so, again, you have these high levels of mercury and cadmium and lead and things that just aren't supposed to be in the human body. And it's especially more toxic to women and children, and especially young children and fetuses, pregnant women. It's devastating.
And the cadmium and the lead, are those primarily water contaminants that we're concerned about, or is it air quality as well?
It can be air, too. Absolutely. It can be air. Yeah, but they're highly concentrated in coal ash.
You talked about before you, with the minorities living closer to the plants, and they seem to locate the plants in the communities of minorities. So we're dealing also with environmental justice issues.
Absolutely, big time.
And is PSR involved in that aspect of the fight?
We are. We have, and it just depends on, we have chapters pretty much scattered across the state, and that's why I'm in Kansas City, because you do have a chapter here in Kansas City. And I'm trying to visit a few as I'm driving across the country to visit my family in Nebraska. But, what we try and do, and again, we often buddy up with our good friends Earth Justice, who you may know as the attorneys for the Earth, and to kind of get in and, you know, with their help, fight some of these communities where this is happening. Both putting power plants next to minority communities, but also wanting to dump coal ash, the waste from that's happening right now in North Carolina. Duke Energy is wanting to dump all of the waste from their coal-fired power plants in a small, poor community, I think in Alabama. Those are issues that obviously we pay attention to.
So how do we get the minority communities more involved? It seems like, at least in my opinion, I think one of the reasons why these corporations are able to locate in those areas is that we've always had a hard time mobilizing those communities to stand up and do something to stop it.
Right.
And they're reactionary, and we've been involved over in Wyandotte County in the past. We were involved in helping some of the minority communities that were testify at EPA hearings relating to some of the Superfund sites, but that's reacting after the site.
Right.
How do we get them involved from the beginning to stop that?
Well, you know, it's really tough, and I think because they don't have the resources, right? They don't have the money, these minority communities. Mm-hmm. They feel that no one's going to pay any attention to them. So I think the best we can do is kind of what we're doing, I think, is getting out there and educating people about it, getting on the news, writing op-eds. I mean, we're at PSR, we're not a... we don't have any lobbyists. We're strictly, you know, we're strictly educators and advocates. And so, in certain situations, we try and bring in other groups, Sierra, whatever, you know, Earth Justice, et cetera, and say, let's, you know, we have to really make this known what they're doing to these people. And hopefully get up to our political leaders.
Okay.
But it's tough because there's so much money out there and you know, the big oil and gas companies and coal and a lot of money.
Now, we talked about the nuclear testing before. Mm-hmm. Let me talk a little bit about, have you addressed the issue of nuclear power plants? What are the concerns there, provided they don't have a meltdown? Obviously, we know what happens if the plant... partially melts down. But what are there health concerns even when the plant is operating correctly?
Well, you know, there are health concerns. A normally operating nuclear power plant will, trying to think of the term for this now, but they normally release during their normal venting process procedures on the plant, they will release low doses of radiation. And there are some good scientific studies done on the dangers of low-dose radiation. Again, especially to the fetus in utero, the pregnant woman, and infants and children, and women in general. Women in general are more sensitive to the effects of radiation, even low-dose radiation, than men. Mary Olson, who is with NIRS, N-I-R-S, she's done a very, very nice paper on the effects of low-dose radiation on women. And, you know, most of the, in our, it's kind of strange and frustrating that the standards, the safety standards in our country are set for a 70-kilogram, Caucasian, 30-year-old male. It really ought to be set at the growing fetus in utero that's about 2 inches long, because their cells are replicating. They're going, you know, their cells are turning over thousands and thousands of times, so they have more tendency to break chromosomes and change DNA that leads to cancer 5 to 70 years later. But that's not, the safety standards are not done at that level in this country. They're done on a much bigger person. So we know that women are more susceptible too to these low doses of radiation.
Okay.
And you know, so nuclear energy is not totally free of polluting, because you have to mine it, transport it. So a lot of fossil fuels and carbon pollution happen in that process. Now once you get to the power plant, then yeah, it doesn't produce carbon pollution. But there are other concerns, obviously. And yes, are there concerns about Fukushima type accident? Absolutely. And you know, that's ongoing. I'm not an expert again in that field. I sit on one of the radiation and health committees. There is a lot of not truthful stuff coming out of Japan about Fukushima, and it is still causing a lot of problems, and we will see more cancers as time goes on, and birth defects like we're seeing from Chernobyl.
Okay. And what about now? I think most people think of Chernobyl as the big accident, but we also had the Three Mile Island incident in Pennsylvania back in the 1979, I think it was.
Yeah, something like that.
Have there been studies on cancer rates?
You know, I think there have, but I can't quote those. I think there have, but I don't know if that was a total meltdown.
I think it was partial,
and right. Yeah, not, it wasn't quite on the par of Chernobyl or Fukushima, but those, you know, the generators at Fukushima are the same ones that are in many of our plants. I think 23 or so of our plants in this country, the GE technology. So, I mean, it's got to be a little bit of a concern, I think.
I know we have a nuclear power plant down in Burlington, Kansas. It's called the Wolf Creek plant. And I know that's been closed down numerous times for maintenance issues, which is a little bit concerning, the frequency. It's good that they close it down when they see
right.
a problem.
Right.
But it's still concerning, I think,
right.
that it yeah. needs that much maintenance and it has to be shut down so frequently. And you wonder if it's on the verge of having some kind of partial meltdown because of all that.
Well, you know, there are those that study this that say it will happen. I mean, our plants are getting older. Some of them are 40, 45 years old. That's old. And, you know, PSR at least, we advocate for no nuclear. We don't want to have nuclear power plants in the world, and yet we know there are a lot of them. And
well, in the fracking situation, there's been studies linking that to some of these earthquakes.
Absolutely.
And so certainly I would think if you have an earthquake that's close to the nuclear power plant because of fracking, that you have a pretty good chance of triggering an incident at the nuclear power plant. Though.
I think you're absolutely right. When you look at the earthquakes that are happening in Oklahoma, it's mind-boggling,
mm-hmm.
and all the fracking going on there. And it's not just the fracking, you know, when they drill down and then go horizontal, you know, and then blast all this high-powered chemical sand mix, and then the backflow. The produced water that comes back, of course, you can't use it for anything. It's not like you can use it for drinking water or clean it. It's full of radioactive material. It's full of all sorts of toxic heavy metals. And so they take it, and then they inject it back into the ground. And that's what I think is happening in Oklahoma, when they inject that stuff under such high pressure back into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's triggering these earthquakes. So a lot of things to worry about. And work on.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. For listeners who have just joined us, you've been listening to Dr. Lynn Ringenberg, who is the current president. You've been president for 2 years now?
No, I've only been since January. I'll be for 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Physicians for Social Responsibility. Their website is psr.org. And if you want to just briefly remind listeners of what the summit will be in Washington, D.C.
Yes, coming up September 20th, we're holding a climate health summit, and it's focused primarily to health professionals, but not anybody can come join us, whoever would like to learn about the health effects from climate change and be a spokesman. And we're hoping that we send a lot of ambassadors out across the country to speak about the health effects from climate change and things we can all do about it. And that's on the 20th. You can get more information from on our website. And then on Monday, for those that want to stay over, we're going to lobby in D.C. So it should be a fun day and a half, 2 days.
Thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. And if you're just joining us, you heard an interview with one of our hosts, Craig Lubow, and Dr. Lynn Ringenberg, the current president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And they were speaking about climate change, toxins, and nuclear power. Now we are going to take a short break and play a few spots. And when we come back, I'll be speaking with Elizabeth Bajan about Revolve Community Bike Shops. And again, this is Natural Lee, and I have in studios with me Elizabeth Bajan with the Revolve Community Bike Shops. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me on.
Erin.
And so let's just begin with, what are the Revolve Community Bike Shops?
Okay. Well, I have been on KKFI before talking about what we do at Revolve. We are a nonprofit bike shop, and we have an Earn a Bike program that helps people get on bicycles. Our mission to rescue, refurbish, and redistribute bicycles as the solution to healthy lifestyles and affordable, earth-friendly transportation is alive and well. And our Earn a Bike program helps us to fulfill that mission. In the course of 5 years, we have helped get close to 900 people.
Wow.
On donated bicycles.
That's neat. So you have been in operation for 5 years.
At the 51st and Truce location. We refer to that as Revolve KC. It's it's by design that we are on the campus of UMKC and adjacent to Rockhurst and on that racial dividing, historical racial dividing line in Kansas City known as Truce. That's why we're there, is to serve to serve people that need transportation. And our second location is at 554 Central Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. We've been there 3 years.
So 900 bikes out to people who need them.
Yes.
So where do you get these bikes?
Well, thanks for asking. We have developed wonderful partnerships on municipal levels. We have great partners, people that are very excited about donating the bikes that they are not using and mm-hmm. getting them to us so that we can do what we do. We participate in huge recycling events with the cities of Overland Park, Lee's Summit, Parkville. In the past, we've had events with Gladstone and Liberty, Lake Lotawanna. So people that are going to these events to properly dispose of electronics are also bringing us their bicycles. They're getting rid of tennis shoes and this and that, and we are just glad to have them. Now, we also have people that walk in bicycles to us, and I do need to put out a plea. Even though we do have a lot of bicycles coming to us, we have seen a resurgence in the demand for our Earn a Bike program among international students. So if to the active listeners there and from KKFI, please bring us your bicycles. Either come to one of our recycling events listed on our Facebook page or just walk them in to us during hours of operation. And the times and days of operation is on our website, revolvekc.org.
So aside from the bikes walked in by just friendly donors, these other bikes that you've collected would have otherwise been sent to landfills?
You're exactly right. And in fact, the City of Lee Summit on a probably a monthly basis will give me a call, shoot me an email, and say, it's time to pick up, Elizabeth. Those folks are very committed to keeping those bicycles out of the landfill. They set them aside for me, and I'll take my little donated truck and trailer out there and keep those bikes from staying in the landfill. I will get those bicycles, and we take those through our Earn a Bike program, or in some of those kids' bikes, we are refurbishing at our expense and then channeling, getting those to some of the groups providing bicycles to children at during the holidays.
So I have a couple questions. The first would be, what other cities do you have partnerships like that with that will call you when it's time?
Not any other landfills, but that's why we have like four or five events throughout the year. And I failed to mention the City of Kansas City, Missouri is one of our newest partners, too.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, and then we are approached by Boy Scout groups and different church events that want to hold bike collections for us. We're very fortunate in that way. It just seems that the supply of bicycles out there is endless. So let's keep the effort around keeping those bikes in circulation to the people that need them for transportation and to get out there and enjoy the trails that we have in Kansas City for reasons of fitness and recreation.
Absolutely. Now, why are you so committed to getting bikes to people who need them, personally? Why are you?
Well, I think that has to do with the fact that I'm a very service-oriented person. I am, by trade, a master's level social worker. So my little mantra is I'm a social worker saving the world one bike at a time. And I have, I wish I were the origin of this belief, but I do like to have it as one of my principles that the bicycle is a tool for empowerment and a vehicle of change. And I've seen the power of a bicycle in my own life. Being the youngest of a large immigrant family, my mother never learned how to drive, never got behind the wheel of a car. So if I needed to go somewhere, I got there under my own human energy, my own woman power, and with public transportation. So as a social worker, I did some research to see if I could bring to Kansas City what is happening all across the nation, the emerging of nonprofit bike shops. And so I wanted to make that happen in Kansas City where it's flourishing in other locations. So I've been to nonprofit bike shops in Topeka, Omaha, New Orleans, and it's just happening everywhere. And the fact that we're 5 years into it perhaps says that we were right about the fact that Kansas City needed this and would support it. And I'm glad to report that, indeed, Kansas City has gotten behind it.
Excellent. Now, just I want to touch on what you said, the power of a bicycle. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, there's a lot of folks out there that they can't afford a bicycle, a car. It's beyond the reach of our low-income residents. So having a bicycle can get somebody to work, to class, to a doctor's appointment. And so one of our next steps is to get our bike safety curriculum that is central in our Earn a Bike program, get that translated into other languages so that we can just open up the ability for people to have earth-friendly transportation. And then our next step after that is to start taking some of the resources that we have to design and produce trailers to transport produce so that our immigrants and low-income residents can get to the grocery store, they can get to the farmers markets, they can go to the gardens that they're tending, and have a way to transport their food home.
Are there any nonprofits or farmers markets in particular that you partner with?
Not yet, but we have been to the one in Kansas City, Kansas, mm-hmm. and I just want to make the point that in our location in Kansas City, Kansas, we are the only dedicated bike shop in all of Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County, meaning here we are a nonprofit, and we're the only dedicated bike shop. Mm-hmm. So then it's no wonder that Wyandotte County has some of the worst health rankings among all the counties in Kansas. However, that is on the change as well with the availability of those farmers markets and doing what we do.
Okay, let's go ahead and talk about that. Tell me about why getting people on bikes is important to you, because of the environment and because of health. I guess I kind of answered the question, but
our tagline is reuse, reduce, recycle, mm-hmm. and revolve. Yeah. And we think we're making a difference. And the pollution, because we're reducing the need for automobiles. We're, like I said, we are on the campus of UMKC in Rockhurst, and they have a car parking problem.
Yes, they do.
And so we're there to alleviate the need for mm-hmm. a car.
And all that idle, mm-hmm. the idle, they wait trying to get out of that parking lot.
Oh, you should.
You spend 20 minutes. Look, I went to this. Anyways, yeah.
Yeah, yeah so. I mean, I'm right across the street of one of the parking mm-hmm. lots, and the students are just circulating, mm-hmm. Trying to find a parking space. So let's just eliminate that and get on a bicycle instead.
I just, reading about Revolve and being in studio here with you today, I just get the vibe of not only the power, the physical power of I can get places, but also like the power of, what is the word? Self-sufficiency.
Exactly. I was going to help you with
Thank
that
you.
One.
Yeah, self-sufficiency. And mm-hmm. do you want to talk about that?
Well, an indicator of a city's vibrancy and vitality is a woman on a bicycle getting to where she needs to go. Mm-hmm. So we just came out of the Women's Bike Summit held by Bike Walk KC. I was part of that bike safety portion of that. And it's just great. You know that Kansas City is on track because more and more women are getting on bicycles, feeling safe. There's more places to engage in physical activity and better ways to get around town to get yourself to where you need to be. Just want to mention that Kansas City, Kansas is laying down the bike lanes all the way from the Argentine area to Quindaro on 10th and 12th Street.
Okay.
So
That's good work.
Yeah. So you're going to be seeing a lot more people riding bicycles in Kansas City, Kansas. I'm going to be part of the 9th annual Built Summit. The 9th annual Built Environment and Outdoor Summit for the state of Kansas.
What's that?
It's just an annual gathering of all kinds of environment group, people interested in the environment, trail advocates, health advocates, all convening together to see what the where the pulse is for the built environment and what's happening outdoors. And I'll be a part of a panel talking about bringing bicycling to the main street. But there's some fantastic keynote speakers. And again, the summit is coming up October 13th through the 15th. And I hope that some of the listeners will perhaps visit that website at kansasbeos.org. Org stands for Built Environment Outdoor Summit, KansasBEOS.org, coming up. And there's a lot happening in the state of Kansas when it comes to the built environment.
So that's an event coming up October 13th through 15th. And where is that being held?
This year it's in Overland Park. So a lot of folks from the Kansas City area will be attending and participating.
Is this for anybody? Is it open to the public?
Yes, it is. So, and again, it's pertinent to those in construction, building trails, health advocates, you know, community, transportation advocates. So there'll be a lot of different trails there.
And then we have one event, but that's not going to be until April of next year, and it's called Revolving Green Around the Blue. What's a little short? What's that about?
Oh, just that we're going to get some of our newbie bike riders out on the trails and teach them about trail stewardship. Those trails don't happen by accident. Those trails need to be maintained, and we want to bring our resources to the table and get people there knowing the importance of keeping those trails clean and available for use.
Well, Elizabeth Bijan of the Revolve Community Bike Shops, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And just like to invite our listeners, check out revolvekc.org. And if you have an old bike laying around, you can go ahead and walk it in to one of their locations at 51st and Troost.
And if you need a bicycle, please check out our Earn a Bike program on our website.
Yes, the Earn a Bike program. Check it out. And now, at this point, I would like to go ahead and share with you some of our environmental events going on around our area. And the first is the Kansas Cinema showing the documentary Plan Eat. It's tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. at the Johnson County Community College campus, building GEB, room 233. And everyone is talking about climate change, but many of us are not sure how we can make a difference. So that's what the event's about. They're going to show you a movie, and that, again, is at Johnson County Community College tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. If you have questions, you can contact Gail at shafton.com. That's S-H-A-F-T-O-N. The 15th Annual Community Forum on Kansas Environmental Issues is Thursday, October 1st, 5:30 p.m. at the Village Presbyterian Church at 6641 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. And you can RSVP for that event on our EcoRadio Facebook page. They have several speakers that will be at that event. And the HRES Energy Solutions Homes Tours is Saturday, October 3rd, starting at 9 a.m. in Kansas City. It's a self-guided tour, and you can find more information about that Energy Solutions Home Tour at heartlandrenewable.org. And finally, climate change and the future of food production with Greg Page, the executive chairman at Cargill, on Monday, October 12th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the K-State Olathe, which is out on, it's a forum hall out at 22201 West Innovation Drive in Olathe, Kansas. You can find more information about all of these events by visiting the Sierra Club Kansas website. And again, thank you for tuning into Eco Radio. We have a song coming up to play for you by the environmentally minded group Solar.
Mm-hmm. sun of our earth. Give us food and warmth to grow, and sun for the children. Give them time, the time to know. In sun of our day, light the truth so we might learn. In sun of our darkest nights, give us faith for your return. In sun wisdom from above, and son of our hearts, oh, fill them with your love, love, love.